Iran and Russia begin joint naval drills north of the Indian Ocean aimed at establishing security for international trade. The U.S. calls for an investigation into a rocket attack on an airbase in Iraq's Erbil that killed a foreign contractor, injuring several others, including an American soldier. And U.S. lawmakers plan to establish an independent commission to probe the January attack on the Capitol by supporters of then-President Donald Trump. Thanks for joining us. Iran and Russia have launched joint naval maneuvers in the north of the Indian Ocean. The maneuvers involve naval and air units of the Navy of the Iranian Army, as well as the Navy of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. A Russian frigate, logistical warship, and helicopter are also taking part. The military exercises are aimed at honing the skills of both countries' naval troops and ensuring maritime security. Drills come to boost security for international maritime trade and to increase capabilities to tackle piracy and terrorism at sea. Among other objectives is to exchange experience on naval aid and rescue operations. The exercises are carried out across an area spanning 17,000 square kilometers. Iran's envoy to the International Atomic Energy Agency has officially informed the UN body of Tehran's decision to end voluntary implementation of the additional protocol. Now, this means that Iran will not give IAEA broader access to its sites or allow snap inspections as of next week. Homolesky reports.
Iran has informed the International Atomic Energy Agency it plans to stop taking voluntary measures that give the agency broader access under the so-called additional protocol. Iran has been implementing the additional protocol voluntarily as part of its commitments under the nuclear deal with world powers known as the JCPOA.
I have delivered a letter from the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran to the Director General of the IAEA specifying that as of 23rd February 2021, Iran will stop all voluntary measures beyond its safeguard commitments as envisaged in the JCPOA.
Kazem Gharibabadi said as of February 23rd, cooperation between Iran and the IAEA would be based solely on the country's safeguards agreement with the agency. If U.S. sanctions are effectively lifted, he added, Iran would resume implementation of all voluntary measures. The decision is in line with a law approved by the Iranian parliament almost 2 months ago, obliging the government to reduce IAEA access and step up nuclear enrichment if U.S. sanctions are not lifted, specifically those imposed against Iranian oil exports and the country's banking system. The previous U.S. administration under President Donald Trump reimposed the sanctions as part of a maximum pressure policy after withdrawing from the nuclear deal in 2018. Meanwhile, Iran has also informed the IAEA of its serious concerns over the protection of confidential information. In an official letter, Iran has asked the agency to revise its policies in order to avoid the far too common instances of IAEA reports being leaked to the media via unauthorized access, potentially threatening the country's national security. Since it was implemented in 2016, the nuclear deal has given the IAEA unprecedented access to Iranian nuclear sites. But that level of cooperation would inevitably come to an end if efforts to revive the JCPOA fail. Homolesky, Vienna.
Washington has called for an investigation into a rocket attack on a military facility of U.S.-led forces in northern Iraq. The Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said the U.S. is outraged by the attack that hit Erbil International Airport in Iraq's Kurdistan region. He said the U.S. supports all efforts to hold accountable those responsible. At least three rockets were fired at the airport. One hit the U.S.-led forces complex, killing a foreign contractor and wounding six others, including an American soldier. Iraq's premier has called for a probe into the attack. President Barham Saleh slammed it as dangerous and criminal. He said it undermined steps taken to safeguard Iraq's security. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says lawmakers will establish an outside, independent commission to review last month's insurrection at the Capitol. Pelosi said in a letter to lawmakers that the commission would be modeled on a similar one convened after the 9/11 attacks in 2001. She added the commission will review the facts and causes related to the deadly Capitol raid by supporters of then-President Donald Trump. This comes after the Senate acquitted Trump on impeachment charges of inciting the attack on the Congress building on January the 6th. Total confirmed COVID cases in the U.S. are approaching 27.7 million. Fatalities to have passed 486,000. Now, that's according to figures by Johns Hopkins University. The U.S. has the largest infection and death tallies in the world. Authorities have urged people to avoid travel, but about 4 million traveled by air from Thursday to Sunday. That marked the past weekend having the highest number of passengers in the U.S. so far this year. Also in the Americas, Brazil on Monday reported over 32,000 new cases and over 500 new fatalities in 24 hours. The country now has nearly 240,000 deaths out of almost 9.9 million cases. Mexico's death toll has jumped to 174,000 from nearly 2 million cases. The UK has reached its ambitious mid-February target of 15 million people inoculating everyone in the country's top four priority groups against COVID-19. But with this successful vaccination gamble come growing calls for lifting of lockdown restrictions and a worried public that's hoping the government knows what it's doing, as Saeed Purza reports.
This country has achieved an extraordinary feat, administering a total of 15 million jabs into the arms of some of the most vulnerable people in the country.
One of few successes in the UK government's handling of a pandemic that's left the country of about 67 million with a higher death toll and worse economic damage than many others. But with the situation improving, should the government open the country up for business? Members of the Prime Minister's own party are calling on him to commit to a timetable for scrapping the lockdown in the coming months. But the Prime Minister says he will only follow the evidence.
We've got to be very prudent. And what we want to see is progress that is cautious but irreversible.
Infections are falling but remain high. And former Prime Minister Tony Blair thinks the way to stop them soaring when the restrictions are eased is to issue vaccine passports, certificates that prove you have received the jab.
I think it's a step too far to have your movement controlled locally by some kind of passport or a piece of paper. I think that's way too far.
Some people cannot be vaccinated because of health reasons. It's just not safe for them. So to discriminate against those people and say, well, you're just not able to go to a coffee shop, go to a different country, that doesn't seem particularly just and fair.
On Monday, Health Secretary Matt Hancock insisted vaccine passports were not for domestic use.
But there are countries that are actively floating this idea and proposing it. And in that case, it will be important for people from the UK to be able to show whether or not they've been vaccinated in order to travel.
That seemed to resonate well with the people we spoke to.
I think it's a really good idea, you know. I think that so as we can travel is the main thing, really, what I'm sort of interested in, getting abroad for a bit of sun.
I think it's a good idea. I think if it means we can get back to doing summer holidays and travelling abroad, seeing family abroad, then I don't see why not.
Monday saw the launching of the UK's hotel quarantine regime, a new 10-day isolation for British residents returning from 33 COVID variant hotspots. Critics say the move is too little too late.
The UK is under an indefinite lockdown at the moment to curb the spread of the virus. Next week, the Prime Minister will unveil his so-called roadmap for the months ahead. But with his track record riddled with failures in handling the pandemic since it began, will Boris Johnson get it right this time? Saeed Purza, London.
The NATO Secretary General has said that the alliance will not withdraw its troops from Afghanistan before the time is right. Earlier, we discussed the matter in detail with our guests in the News Review program. Let's take a listen.
NATO's Secretary General has poured cold water on a possible pullout from Afghanistan by May, saying that would depend on the situation on the ground.
The Taliban must reduce violence, negotiate in good faith, and live up to their commitment to stop cooperating with international terrorist groups. So our presence is conditions-based. While no ally wants to stay in Afghanistan longer than necessary, we will not leave before the time is right.
Stoltenberg blamed the Taliban for the recent rise in violence in Afghanistan. He urged the militant group to reduce violence and negotiate in good faith under the February 2020 peace deal with the United States. Under the agreement, Washington pledged that all foreign troops will leave Afghanistan by upcoming May in return for guarantees from the militants to enter a peace process with the Afghan government. The Taliban now say, with the withdrawal in question, they will have to continue their fight against foreign military forces in Afghanistan. Joining us is our correspondent in the Afghan capital, Kabul, Amin Alami, and we also have Keith Preston, independent journalist and researcher out of Richmond. Gentlemen, welcome. Amin, firstly, if you can provide us with an update and what the reaction has been on the ground there in Afghanistan.
Of course, the story of the presence of foreign military forces, mainly U.S. troops in Afghanistan beyond May, has created mixed reactions in Afghanistan. The Afghan government has its own stance regarding to this issue. The country's national security advisor, Hamdullah Mohib, recently emphasized that despite Afghan security and defense forces are enough capable to dependently defend the country against the terrorist groups, it also welcomes the presence of foreign military forces in Afghanistan and said that such attempt is considered as a move that is in line with the shared interests between Kabul and as well as between Kabul and Washington. In the meantime, many others believe that the presence of foreign military forces here in Afghanistan will give extra pretext for the extremist groups, mainly the Taliban, to further wage the war and violence in this country under the pretext of fighting the foreign military forces and invasion forces. But let's not forget that some regional countries also have their own stance and viewpoints regarding to the presence of foreign troops in Afghanistan. Like the Afghan government, many here in the region call on the U.S. and NATO to withdraw responsibly from Afghanistan and guarantee many important and vital issues such as freedom, democracy, and women rights, and as well as human rights in this country.
All right. Keith, when we think of Afghanistan, you think of violence and, you know, failure with regards to the foreign forces. And, you know, you have a lot of the top U.S. military officials. The U.S. are the ones that have spearheaded this invasion of Afghanistan that admit to that. There has been violence, and the Taliban have gained more ground. Isn't it time for foreign forces to withdraw from Afghanistan, in your opinion, because they've done nothing to reduce the violence? I can't think of a market in Kabul that hasn't been blown up yet. And when it comes to training the local security forces to prevent the violence, it's been a failure there as well. Why not leave that to other people?
Well, I think before there can be any real peace in Afghanistan, the Americans are simply going to have to withdraw. That's going to be one of the necessary preconditions. The Americans, what they have done in their 20-year war in Afghanistan is essentially take every problem that Afghanistan had previously and exacerbate it. It's not true that Afghanistan is an inherently violent society. If we go back and look at what Afghanistan was like, say in the 1960s, we see that Afghanistan was actually a fairly progressive country in the region. What's happened is that half a century of war and violence have done extreme amounts of damage to Afghanistan. But for Afghanistan to be able to rebuild, the foreign interference that takes place in Afghanistan is going to have to be removed. The Americans need to withdraw. That's the first step. We also have to consider that the Taliban are not a group that is indigenous to Afghanistan. They're not reflective of traditional Afghan culture in any sense. They are an extremist terrorist movement that was imported into Afghanistan largely in the 1980s by Saudi Arabia and with the support of the United States. So we need to see American influence removed from Afghanistan. We also need to see any Saudi influence removed from Afghanistan. Now, as far as any kind of peacekeeping agreements of other nations outside of Afghanistan are going to be involved in that, it's going to be have to be countries that have a stake in a secure and prosperous and peaceful Afghanistan, and that's not the Americans.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your contribution there. Let me thank our guests for their valuable time and input. We had Amin Alami in the Afghan capital, Kabul, and Keith Preston, independent journalist and researcher, joining us out of Richmond.
Palestinian prisoners in an Israeli jail have gone on a partial strike in protest over the escalated repressive measures by the prison administration against them. Mona Kandil has more.
Palestinian prisoners incarcerated in the Israeli military jail of Aofir started a partial strike by refusing to take their meals in protest against the escalated successive repression and assaults of the Israeli prison service. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club Association, for almost 2 weeks, prisoners in Aofir jail have been subjected to harassment and repression, including surprise night raids and intensive unannounced cell search, strip searches, and being sprayed with poisonous gases, in addition to deliberate medical negligence.
A big number of administrative detainees are held in Aofir. What's going on there amounts to a crime being planned by the prison's officials. They want to bring the prisoners of Aofir to their knees. They have escalated their aggressive measures, such as carrying out several surprise searches of cells day and night.
Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held in Aofir jail, including minors. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the inmates have sent a clear message to the prison administration that if these invasions and assaults that are against international laws and the Geneva Convention do not come to an end, then the prisoners will escalate their protest measures within the coming days.
Prisoners' lives are in danger because they don't intend to remain silent against this brutality. Prisoners now are planning other measures to protest their conditions, including refusal to talk with prison administrators and starting an open-ended hunger strike.
Reports say over 4,500 Palestinians are currently languishing in a number of Israeli jails, including hundreds being held without charge or trial under the illegal imprisonment known as administrative detention. Palestinian prisoners have always endured grievous oppression in Israeli jails. However, people in the occupied territories are worried today about their loved ones. They are concerned not only about recent brutal measures taken in the Israeli jail of Aofir, but also about the reports that more inmates there and in other jails have been tested positive for the coronavirus. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Seven Republican senators who broke ranks by voting to convict former President Donald Trump at his impeachment trial faced immediate hostility and criticism from fellow conservatives, revealing the potentially high cost of opposing Trumpism within the Republican Party. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Victoria Bekempis. The piece is titled, Seven Republican Rebels Who Voted to Convict Feel Trumpists' Fury. Stay with us for more. Seven Republican senators who broke ranks by voting to convict former President Donald Trump at his impeachment trial faced immediate hostility and criticism from fellow conservatives, revealing the potentially high cost of opposing Trumpism within the Republican Party. These senators, North Carolina's Richard Burr, Louisiana's Bill Cassidy, Maine's Susan Collins, Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, Utah's Mitt Romney, Nebraska's Ben Sass, and Pennsylvania's Pat Toomey, brought the total number of guilty votes to 57. That was not nearly enough to secure a conviction, but easily enough to ensure instant attack from fellow Republicans and others on the right of the Republican Party. The reaction was a powerful illustration of the strength of Donald Trump's grip on the Republican Party, even though he's out of office. Let's impeach Renos from the Republican Party. Donald Trump's son and conservative favorite, Donald Trump Jr., said on Twitter, using the insulting acronym for Republicans in name only, RENO. The instant backlash came from powerful right-wing media figures as well. Conservative Fox News host Laura Ingraham commented, Prediction, none of the Republicans who voted in the affirmative today would speak at the 2024 GOP convention. For Senator Cassidy, there was almost instant retribution from his own state. Jeff Landry, the Republican Attorney General of Louisiana, tweeted, Senator Bill Cassidy's vote is extremely disappointing. The local party agreed and its executive committee unanimously voted to censure Cassidy for his vote. We condemn in the strongest possible terms the vote today by Senator Bill Cassidy to convict former President Donald Trump. Fortunately, clearer heads prevailed, and President Trump has been acquitted of the impeachment charge filed against him, the Republican Party of Louisiana similarly said in a statement. Bill Cassidy was not alone, as Richard Burr's state party in North Carolina also went immediately on the attack. Michael Whatley, North Carolina's Republican Party chair, condemned his colleague in a statement saying, North Carolina Republicans sent Senator Burr to the United States Senate to uphold the Constitution, and his vote today to convict in a trial that he declared unconstitutional is shocking and disappointing. Even Republicans who voted to acquit Donald Trump were not necessarily spared from conservative backlash, including the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. The lawmaker said that he voted to acquit over a jurisdictional issue and because Donald Trump was no longer in office, Mitch McConnell didn't think impeachment was in its purview. However, McConnell also firmly criticized Donald Trump following the acquittal, saying, "There is no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of that day, and that he's still liable for everything he did whilst he was in office. He didn't get away with anything yet." Trump's circle was displeased at the lack of fealty, despite the vote to acquit. If only Mitch McConnell was so righteous as the Democrats trampled Trump and the Republicans whilst pushing Russia collusion theory for 3 years, or whilst Democrats incited 10 months of violence, arson and rioting. Yet then he just sat back and did nothing, said Trump Jr. These attacks come as party-line Republicans have ratcheted up their efforts to unseat dissenting conservatives in upcoming primaries. The 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach Trump are already seeing primary opponents trying to unseat them and replace them with Trump loyalists. Matt Gaetz, a Florida Republican congressman and dogged Trump loyalist, even flew to Cheyenne in Wyoming in late January to hold a rally against senior Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who backed impeachment. "Defeat Liz Cheney in this upcoming election," Matt Gaetz commented. "And Wyoming will bring Washington to its knees. How can you call yourself a representative when you don't represent the will of the people?" Matt Gaetz also described Liz Cheney, the daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney, as a beltway bureaucrat turned fake cowgirl that supported an impeachment that is deeply unpopular in the state of Wyoming.
The debate.
Iran has stated that if other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal do not fulfill their obligations by February 21st, Tehran will suspend snap inspections by the UN nuclear watchdog. The ministry says the move will be in line with the Iranian parliament's recent legislation. Why is the U.S. stalling on returning to the nuclear deal which it left, yet pressuring Iran to return to the deal? Is there a way to break this impasse, or will the U.S. miss out on this opportunity? Stay tuned to the debate.
Despite his statements during his campaigns, the new U.S. president has not revived the Iran nuclear deal yet. And in the coming days, tensions may rise, as Tehran earlier announced some more rollbacks as of February 21st. The move is based on a legislation adopted by Iran's parliament that requires the country to speed up uranium enrichment and end its commitment under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It was on Sunday that the U.S. Secretary of State said in a tweet that, quote, "principled policy is the best way to ensure Iran does not acquire a nuclear weapon. We raised the issue at the weekly presser of the foreign ministry, and the spokesman refused to comment on Anthony Blinken's tweet, but said the U.S. is still following the wrong policy of maximum pressure by former President Donald Trump regarding the 2015 nuclear deal.
Unfortunately, the new U.S. administration is still acting the same as the previous one. What happens today is not different from what was the condition before January 20th. We see that the maximum pressure campaign and cruel sanctions continue against Iran."
Khatibzadeh further added that the maximum pressure policy had failed and advised the White House to lift sanctions soon.
"The U.S. policy of maximum pressure against Iran had failed, and these policies could not continue. We think that if these sanctions are effectively lifted as soon as possible, the way forward will be smoother."
If within the coming days the US does not revive the Iran nuclear deal, the Islamic Republic will stop the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol. It was in 2003 that Tehran signed an additional protocol granting access to the UN nuclear watchdog to inspect and verify the country's nuclear activities. According to the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran has accepted the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol in return for lifting sanctions. However, following Donald Trump's withdrawal from the agreement, the sanctions have been increasing day by day, and the Islamic Republic sees no reason to implement these protocols anymore. It has to be noted that Iran will still accept inspections based on the safeguard agreement.
Although Tehran has clearly announced that it will not go back to its commitments before Washington removes sanctions, the U.S. is still dragging feet from returning to the JCPOA, and it may lose the chance as Iran will take another step to reduce its commitments. Mouman Avedi, Tehran.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, journalist and author Daniel Lazar, joins us from New York. We also have journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsin Abbas, who joins us from London. I'd like to welcome you both. Daniel Lazar, let me first start with you. It's interesting the way that this news is being reported. You have on the one hand one headline, and it's a basic Google search, saying that Iran says that it has told the IAEA of plans to end snap inspections. So this is indeed what has happened. But then you have other headlines, Iran threatens to block snap IAEA inspections. You can see that there might be a different take at the way that this is being reported. And basically, just to make sure we're clear, Iran has informed the UN nuclear watchdog about its plan to end the inspections given to the agency under that 2015 nuclear deal, and it announced the date by February 21, which is in line with Iranian Parliament's recent legislation. It doesn't mean that the inspections are going to end. It's the snap inspections that are complementary that are going to end. I just want to make sure that's clear out on the table. So given that, what's your reaction to this announcement?
Well, I mean, Iran is its legal position is impeccable. There's no question that it has a right to end these inspections. The other signatories have all either pulled out or failed to hold up their end of the bargain. Therefore, Iran is perfectly within its rights in ceasing to maintain its obligations under the pre-existing treaty. I mean, it's very strange. I mean, Obama and Biden negotiated the treaty in 2015. All parties pronounced themselves satisfied with the terms of the agreement and how it was being implemented. And everyone agreed that Iran was abiding by the terms of the agreement. Then Donald Trump attacked the deal as the worst treaty in history. Democrats said they were shocked. And then Trump pulled out in May 2018, imposed devastating economic sanctions on Iran. But now that Trump has been defeated, Biden is in effect repudiating his own handiwork, refusing to go back to the original treaty, refusing to remove sanctions until Iran satisfies other requirements. And this is completely outrageous. I mean, legally, the U.S. does not have a leg to stand on. And it's very strange that Biden is essentially turning his back on his own handiwork. And if I may say, the reason for that is obvious, is that America's two or three main allies in the Middle East, Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, etc., would go ballistic, are totally opposed to any return to the JCPOA. So the U.S. feels it has no choice but to go along. So the U.S. in many ways is a prisoner of its own policy, its own alliances in the Middle East, and therefore it can't go counter to what Israel and the Saudis want. In fact, indeed, Israel, if the U.S. were to return to the JCPOA, Israel has made it pretty clear that it would launch a military attack against Iran. And that attack, in certain respects, would be against the U.S., but the U.S. is unable to say no.
Right. So you pretty much covered what most of my topics were going to be. Might as well just wrap up the show and go home.
No, but when you talk about Israel there, say, Mohsen Abbas, let's not forget when Iran's parliament passed this February 21 deadline and the limit to the inspections under the snap inspections, that was during the time, it was pretty much in that same exact time frame when Iranian nuclear scientist Dr. Fakhrizadeh was assassinated. And of course, Iran was rightly so concluding that Israel was behind this. So we have that behind what Iran's parliament did, which was to obviously lift the snap inspections. Do you think, given all that Daniel Lazar has said there, that Iran had the right and is in the right to do this?
Well, there's no doubt that Iran has been in the right on the JCPOA issue right from the day it was signed. The fact of the matter is that Israel has been undermining that deal since before it got signed. They didn't want it to happen. It's a miracle that actually John Kerry and Obama and co actually even signed it. But some of us are suspicious that they only signed it knowing that they wouldn't be back in office terribly soon, and that these things get organized by the system and the mechanics behind the so-called presidency, that in fact the system, the U.S. system behind all of these political front men, if you like, is actually hell-bent on a very, very singular mission. And that singular mission is to make Iran bend its knee to world institutions, money lender institutions, the American institutions, the military arms complex, whoever you want to call it, the British, the Bank of International Settlements. You know, they want Iran to totally bend its knee, to bow to the power of these forces. Iran hasn't done that in an absolute way, and until it does, I'm afraid that deals like the JCPOA are doomed to failure. And of course, Iran has given it the maximum effort, in all its sincerity, to try to make something of this deal, even though I would say it was not in Iran's interests. Fine, yes, they would have had certain economic sanctions that would have been lifted from Iran had the JCPOA held, and there may have been some temporary alleviation of some of the kind of maximum economic terrorism or pressure, call it what you like, that they've been inflicting on Iran. But in the long run, what it would have done is it would have actually been quite detrimental for Iran, because Iran's own reliance on itself, its own self-sustainability, its own, if you like, internal discussion about whether Iran should have as independent as a policy as they have, or whether they should comply and collaborate with these kind of very, if you like, belligerent world powers and their interests. Well, the Americans' withdrawal from the JCPOA basically pushed Iran into becoming even more self-sufficient, and I think that's a healthy thing for Iran. And what will the Israelis want in return for Iran to pull out or to come back into this deal? What would they actually want? They'll want Iran to hand over its ballistic missiles programs. They'll want it to stop defending any regional interests it has, as well as basically nuking any chance of their civilian or their sort of peaceful nuclear program. Are those three, if you like, consequences acceptable to the Iranian people? Are they acceptable to the Iranian establishment? I certainly don't think in their interest, and I don't think the Iranian establishment is going to buy this Israeli pressure on America to bring in the idea of ballistic missiles and regional, if you like, reduction of Iran's interests.
Well, not only that, Iran's leader, Daniel Lazar, has stated that the U.S. needs to lift its sanctions, and then for it to be operational, the lifting of the sanctions, and then Iran will return back to the deal. It almost sounds very simple. And then there's some who are saying, well, who's going to blink first, or who's going to come in first? But there isn't yet a mechanism to, or whatever you want to call it, to make sure that this happens, for example, the U.S. to return back to the deal. I mean, what can facilitate this process, do you think?
Well, the idea of who's going to blink first, I think, is completely inappropriate, because The U.S. position is completely outrageous. It's totally illegal, and Iran's position is on firm legal ground. So I just I think that the entire world should recognize that if it believes in international law, if international law stands for anything, then the world should recognize that that Iran is in the right. It has been harmed. It deserves restitution. In fact, I'm surprised that Iran is not demanding some kind of compensation for the years of serious economic damage that it has sustained at U.S. hands for absolutely no good reason.
It has done that. It has time and again requested that also. But at this point, that could be something that they just haven't highlighted as much as they did before. So Mohsen Abbas, we know the stance that Biden had during his run when it came to Iran, that it wanted to return to the nuclear deal. We can see that indeed is not something that is happening. And the clearest example was during that CBS interview when the presenter asked about Biden coming back and lifting the sanctions, basically saying, asking whether he would halt the sanctions to have Iran return back to the bargaining table, and then Biden said no. Is that something that Biden is going to now change, given the fact that Iran has set this deadline? Because this was prior to Iran and not making the announcement of the deadline. Do you think that stance by Biden may change?
I think it's highly unlikely. I don't think there's anything that the American government is going to do without the interests of Israel and its own interests as well in that region. And I don't think that it can really bring itself to trust Iran, because Iran has far too much political acumen, and it has far too much, wisdom and understanding about how to play the game, in that sort of region. And I think ultimately Iran is very clear that in order to be safe and in order to be secure, it must have a full defense weapons program, which is not interfered by outside forces. It's said over and over again that it has no intention of producing nuclear weapons. Ayatollah Khamenei has even issued it as a sort of religious edict in ways. He's constantly said that we are not interested in weapons that can mass destroy humanity. So, these are assurances that the Iranian establishment has given, that they want this nuclear weaponry issue to only be, raised in the context that actually the Americans themselves are threatening the Iranians constantly with their U.S. bases surrounding every corner of Iran's geography. Israel, of course, has to be brought into the equation again, because they have 400 nuclear weapons. What if the Iranian establishment was to turn around to America and say, look, actually, you know what, we're really not interested in this JCPOA agreement, because you've got our main enemy, our enemy number one, other than yourselves, Israel, sitting there within a perfect capability to nuclear attack our cities, and yet you're saying nothing to the Israelis. They have these 400 plus nuclear weapons. They're not part of the nuclear proliferation treaty. They're not part of any agreements on an international level, nor are they being pressured either by the Americans or internationally. So how come Iran, which doesn't have nuclear weapons, has no intention of making nuclear weapons, isn't indicating any capacity to make nuclear weapons, is questioned to the point where, it's sanctioned economically in a most inhumane manner. No nation has suffered the level of economic, sanctions that the Americans have imposed on Iran. Yet they're right in front of the Americans' view with complete nuclear arsenal, missiles pointing directly at Tehran and Iranian and other, institutions and establishments in that region that don't like the Zionist imperialist if you like, expansionism in that region, the Balkanization, yet Israel gets asked nothing. So I think Mr. Biden needs to have a little look at his friends in the Senate and in the lobby areas of the Capitol Hill and question why on earth America can't get out of supposedly the most powerful nation in the world, with the biggest military, with the most money in the world, if you like. Why is it so ransomed to Israel? Is it Israel that runs the policies of America, or is it something else? It's rather confusing as to why America takes such a belligerent stand and says nothing on Iran and says nothing to Israel about its nuclear weapons.
Right. That is something that Iran has wrestled with time and again. Daniel Lazar, and now that we're talking about that, we should also mention how Saudi Arabia, who's been not only critical of Iran returning back to the deal, is through the French president has relayed that Saudi Arabia should be part of the negotiations or included in the talks. And Saudi Arabia is concealing its nuclear program, not allowing any inspections, which this smacks of basically double standards. But let's move on to some of the appointments by Biden, if we can here, Daniel Lazar. We're looking at the special envoy on Iran, Rob Malley. We're looking at the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, not to mention John Kerry and Ernest Moniz, who are serving in other capacity in the Biden administration. I mean, if they all were sitting at a table, I don't know, let's say for Thanksgiving, then the only missing party would be Iran, because these were all the people who were involved in the negotiations. So you would think that it's all set, and they should, as you mentioned in my first question, in your first comments, that this team was the one that negotiated the deal. So they should come back to the deal. All the players practically all the players are there. Do you think that in some sense, is a positive sign?
Well, it is, I suppose, a positive sign, but the situation has changed. U.S. policy has shifted to the right. It's become more hostile to Iran, as difficult as it is to imagine, given the level of hostility that pertained in 2015. And the U.S. is definitely determined to isolate Iran, to beat back its influence, to hamstring the government. Therefore, re-entering the JCPOA is a lot more difficult than negotiating it was back in 2015. Robert Malley is a very interesting guy. He has been a critic of U.S. policy in the Middle East. He has accused the U.S. of actually siding with the religious sectarianism of Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states, which is of course true, means that Iran and its allies have been the victim of naked bigotry backed by the U.S. But Mali is coming under attack from pro-Israel and pro-Saudi forces in Washington. So we'll see how long he lasts in the job. But if he is given the boot, which certainly seems possible, then we'll know that the JCPOA, as far as the Biden administration is concerned, is completely dead and buried.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Daniel Lazar, journalist and author. And thank you, Seymour Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mika Vitale, entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام كل وعاء يضيق بما جعل فيه إلا وعاء العلم فإنه يتسع به.
أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام said, "Every container gets narrower according to what is placed in it, except knowledge, which expands instead."
Back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Now, one of the great lessons which we learned from Imam Ali alayhi salam is that there is always a proof of Allah upon the people on earth at all times. Now, dear friends, that might have been a little bit of a heavy statement, but what it is being said is that, so Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah, God, the great, the mighty, the exalted, He has different proofs, different, let's say, arguments. In the Arabic, it is called hujja, right, which is loosely translated as proof or argument. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not that he needs any proof for his existence as per se, but of course human beings want to see the proof of Allah, right? And so in this manner, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has a hujjah on the earth at all times, has a proof on the earth at all times, so that when people look at this hujjah, they look at this proof, they clearly see that this is a proof of the existence of Allah. And so talking to Kumail ibn Ziyad, one of his faithful companions, his loyal companions, Imam Ali alayhi salam says to him, "This is because I am a proof of Allah on the earth for people. The earth is never deplete of a leader who propagates divine guidelines among people, whether he is seen openly by people in society or he is in hiding out of fear of the oppressor's tyranny. This appointment of Imam is an undisputable divine tradition to prevent the evident proofs of Allah from being put into oblivion." And so a beautiful and profound lesson, dear friends, that the earth always has this proof of Allah, this manifestation of the truth of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala upon the earth, whether they are seen openly by the people or this imam, this proof of Allah is hiding. A very beautiful reference to the imam of our time, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. A beautiful lesson regarding the hujjah, the proof of Allah upon the earth, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.